So at the end of all this, right, once you've gone through this process, we've assessed it, I can now give you the answer. It would have been much easier if I just skipped ahead to this bit, wouldn't it? Yeah? I wouldn't have to worry about all that complicated stuff. I do promise that in the next classes, we're actually going to start talking about the Dhamma at some point, okay? So we've just been doing background stuff, all right? Background and context and history, and it's kind of interesting in its own way, but we will get there, right? But we need to look at some of the background. So at the end of the day, what in our opinion, mostly, what can we say is early? And it's one of this is one of those things where there are some things where you can say with a fairly high degree of confidence it's early. Other things you can say with a high degree of confidence it's late. Other things where you can't really say, but you can make some generalizations. And remember, with these generalizations, this is a bit like the climate and the weather. Okay, so remember that. You know, you can't, if somebody says, "Is it going to rain tomorrow?" You can't necessarily say with 100. Well, you probably can if you're in Singapore, can't you? I was thinking about in Australia, but anyway, if you're in Australia and they say, "Is it going to rain tomorrow?" You can't necessarily say if it's going to rain tomorrow or not. Right? But if you're going to ask, well, is it going to rain during the rainy season? You can say, well, almost certainly it's going to rain during the rainy season. Yeah. So it's the same thing with the suttas. You know, you can't always say, is this passage early or is that sutta early? But you can sort of say, well, that mass of suttas, that mass of teachings has all those characteristics which appear to be early. So at the end of the conclusion, what is early? Most of the doctrinal passages attributed to the Buddha in the suttas. Okay? Important distinction to make here, and one which is regularly ignored, even by people who should know better, like Buddha studies scholars. Okay? We looked earlier, we had this criteria of the testimony of the tradition, right? What does the tradition actually say? Right? Now, when we read the suttas, right, the suttas don't actually say that everything they say is from the Buddha. Right? The suttas start out, "Thus have I heard. At one time the Buddha was saying in so and so and so and so." Well, that bit wasn't spoken by the Buddha. Right? The Buddha didn't talk about himself like that. That bit was spoken by who? Well, somebody else at some later time. Okay? So the suttas themselves distinguish between those things which are called those yebite suttanda tathagata bhasita, those suttas spoken by the Buddha. Okay, that's regarded as the most important thing. So it's actually the verbal utterances of the Buddha himself, okay, recorded in the suttas. That's the core thing. That's what everything else is about, right? That's why they went to such incredible efforts to create and maintain and sustain this literature throughout the years, because they believed that those things which the Buddha said were of such incredible value that they needed to be preserved. Okay, so that's the core of it, is the actual teachings attributed to the Buddha in the suttas. Second thing is that some of the framing narratives and teachings by disciples in the suttas, but here we're a bit more conservative about it. Many of the framing narratives, right? The Buddha was saying in Sāvatthī and such and such and such and such. Well, generally speaking, you know, we've seen that the social and cultural conditions seem to be right. They seem to be talking about the right period of time. But on the other hand, often those things are very stereotyped. Right? It's just a kind of a standard beginning and ending that they put on the suttas. But also, when we do the comparative study, we find that quite frequently the narrative framework of the sutta will disagree, even when the content of the sutta is in great agreement. Okay? So that makes sense. So the suttas, the disciples, they weren't so worried about questions like where a sutta was taught or something like that. They were worried about what the content of it was. So think of it like packaging, right? Think of it, we have this idea, right? It's an interesting idea of the Pitaka, right? We think we have like the Tripitaka, the three baskets, okay? What does that mean, right? Well, what are the three baskets? Remember, we're talking about an oral literature, right? Now, if you've got manuscripts, yes, you can put manuscripts in an actual basket, yeah? But if you've got an oral text, you can't put it in a basket. What are you going to do? Your monks walking around with their heads in baskets, right? Huh? doesn't make sense. Obviously, it's a metaphorical sense, right? What's a basket? Well, a basket is something, is a container for keeping something safe, right? A container for keeping something safe. How do you store things, right? How do you store valuable things? You wrap them up, right? You wrap them up and you put them in a neat little box, yeah? Imagine that, yeah? That's how they kept things safe. Yeah, think of you have some food or something valuable. You wrap it like in a banana leaf and you pack it tightly with other things wrapped in banana leaves and then you wrap them in something else. That's what the suttas are. The stories in the suttas are the banana leaves. Yeah, thus have I heard at one time the Buddha was saying and such and such. This is like a cladding which you put around the sutta. Just like in a modern book, it has its covers, right? The covers aren't so essential to the actual content of the book, right? And it so happens that sometimes you lose the covers, right? That's what the covers are there for, right? So that if something gets lost, that's what's lost. It doesn't matter too much, yeah? The main content is still kept, yeah? So all of that stuff, the beginning, the ending and so on, that's the cladding. That's what's keeping it safe. That's not the actual content, okay? So other material which is early, the Parimokkha, right? The list of rules for the monks and nuns and some other Vinaya material. Now, on the whole, the Vinayas are significantly later than the suttas, okay? And the Vinaya material consists of the rules for monks and nuns, origin stories of those rules, explanations, and so on and so forth. Now, the rules themselves are virtually identical across all of the different Vinayas, okay? But the explanations of those rules, the background stories of those rules, the analysis of those rules can vary quite considerably from one Vinaya to the other. So those things are records of the traditions of the teachers in different monasteries in different locations who would teach and explain the Vinaya rules each in their own way, okay? So they kept the rules the same, but the explanations of those rules differ somewhat, and that's what we find in the different Vinayas, okay? Some of the verses are also early, so Dhammapada, Udana, and Terattarīgata, and so on and so forth. And in addition, we have occasional passages and quotes in later literature. So in Abhidhamma literature, Mahayana sutras, for example, Prajnaparamita sutra has quotes almost verbatim the first section of the Saripatthana sutta, okay? Except instead of saying here a monk goes forth and returns being mindful, then it says here a bodhisattva goes forth and returns being mindful. Okay, so it's almost word for word the same. So all throughout the Buddhist literature we find quotes and references to the suttas, and so this is also can be a useful source for early Buddhist material. So that's essentially what we have. What is not early? Right? Abhidhamma, roughly 200 plus years after the Buddha is the Abhidhamma. So the Abhidhamma should be thought of as the attempts by the early schools, right, during the time of the first schism to systematize and organize the teachings each in their own way. Okay, so whereas the suttas are almost all in common with just a tiny bit different, right, in the Abhidhammas we have almost all different with just a tiny bit in common. Okay. Jatakas also date from 100 to 400 years or so after the Buddha. Maybe one or two Jatakas might be early, possibly, but the vast bulk of them are folk tales and legends and so on, which gradually became incorporated into Buddhism at a later date. There's a lot of common Jatakas among the traditions, but they bear all the signs of being sort of shared stories. It's not like in the suttas you have identical texts which are shared. With things like Jatakas you might have the same story but it's told in quite different ways, right? So it's like a kernel of a story which is told in different ways in the oral tradition. Other late books in the Kuddhika, the Peta Vimanavattu, the Charyapitaka, Buddhavamsa and so on, these are all date from roughly the same period, 200 plus years after the Buddha. Most of the Vinaya should be dated, I think, around 100 to 200 years after the Buddha, roughly. I mean, it began to be composed earlier, but that's, I would put the main date. Mahayana texts starting from around 400 years after the Buddha, maybe 500 years for the very earliest Mahayana suttas, but most of the Mahayana suttas are more like 600-800 years after the Buddha, or even up to 1,000 years or even later in some cases. Some additions were made to the agamas, even to the early texts, and so not everything we find in the suttas should be regarded as early. Certain verses, legendary elaborations, and proto-Abhidhamma material was added, but these additions are usually minor and easy to identify. And as the course goes on, we'll have a look at some of these things and we'll show you how to identify them. And also another thing which is late is the various lives of the Buddha. Right? So there's, of course, many events in the life of the Buddha embedded in the suttas, but the creation of sort of coherent biographies of the Buddha is something that happened later, again, in the time of King Ashoka or something like that. Okay, so any questions on that? What's early and what's not early? And I just should remark that, generally speaking, you know, this analysis that I've given here is fairly broadly accepted throughout all of the kind of academic study of Buddhism. This is more or less taken for granted, these things, and none of it's particularly controversial.
Bhante. Are there any sutra contents which is the same but then being told at different places, more than one place?
Yes, I mean that happens occasionally within, say, the Pali Canon, where you find basically the same sutta taught in a few different places. But it also happens in the comparative suttas, where, say, the same sutta might in Pali be set in Savatthi, and in the Chinese might be set in Rajagaha or something like that. So that happens quite frequently, actually.
Therefore, the framing could well be right then, that sometimes it could seem sutra, but then, as you say,
well,
you thought, yes.
That's right, yes. Yeah. So in some cases, of course, the Buddha might have taught the same teaching in different places, right? So the fact that there are the different backgrounds doesn't mean that it's inauthentic, okay? But that also depends. If it's just a straight teaching, then that could easily be the case. On the other hand, if it's a dialogue with a certain person, then it's unlikely that they had the same conversation with the same person in two different places. Yeah, so you have to look at each of those cases case by case. But certainly in the case of more straightforward, simple suttas, it's very likely that he gave more or less the same teaching in many different places. Yeah.
Ajahn, the Jatakas compiles a lot of Buddhist stories, and my question is, are all the stories necessarily able to map back to somewhere that it's being mentioned in the sutta, or whether, you know, the story sometimes could be just the story by itself, but you can't find any trace or elements of it in all the suttas? Then the second question.
Let's clarify. What do you mean by what do you mean by elements of the stories?
Okay, that means like whether all the stories are their roots actually originated from somewhere in one of the suttas?
No.
No, not necessarily.
Not just not necessarily, but almost never. I mean, it was remarked by Rhys Davids many years ago that it's not the case that there are some non-Buddhist elements in the Jatakas, right? It's the case that there are remarkably few Buddhist elements in the Jatakas, okay? So it's very hard. Actually, you can read dozens of Jataka stories before coming across anything that's characteristically Buddhist, okay? Now, of course, the Jatakas themselves have their own framing narrative, right? So the tale is enclosed in its kind of Buddhist framework, right? But most of the time, if you look at the story itself, there's actually nothing Buddhist about it. In fact, in some cases, quite frequently, it's quite anti-Buddhist. I mean, there are some terrible things that the Bodhisattva does in the Jatakas, right? But in some cases, yes, there is a Buddhist teaching and a Buddhist message and so on in there. But in many cases, it was just clearly adopted from just a folk tale or something like that. Usually it has some kind of moral. It's not as if it's you know, against Buddhist teachings or something like that. But it's usually just some kind of general moral or something which isn't particularly Buddhist. You know, it just doesn't really. It's just a general moral message or something. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Also, I mean, also the other things in the Jatakas. The Jatakas are very a peculiar literature because they are both earlier and later than the suttas. Okay? They were compiled later and they mention a lot of social conditions and things which pertain to a later time, but they also mention a lot of things which were earlier than the suttas. So in many cases they're a kind of a record of a folk and oral storytelling tradition which may well have roots. They're going back before the time of the Buddha. So there's a kind of curious mix, but within the Jatakas there's so, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stories. So you find all different kinds of things there. Yeah.
Thank you.
But Jatakas are very, very rich literature. Yeah, you find all kinds of things. Jatakas include the world's first detailed description of abseiling techniques. Yes, you never thought you'd find that in Buddhism, right? How to get the ropes, how to put the rocks, the piggots into the rocks and climb up and loose them and get there, and then how to sail down on the other side using a hang glider. Yes, it's all there in the Jataka stories, yeah. All kinds of practical information you didn't know that you needed to know. Okay, very good. Yes, one more.
Okay, how about the commentaries of the Dhammapada?
Mm-hmm.
All the stories inside.
Yeah, well, again, a similar thing. I mean, these are just stories which have accumulated down through the years. It may be that some of them have some historical basis in the time of the Buddha, but in most cases they don't seem to. Yeah.
So is there a way to tease out which are the genuine one and which are the added ones?
I haven't studied that collection in detail, so I couldn't really say. But I think you'd be safe to sort of assume that unless you've got some good reason, that most of them are probably late. Yeah.
Most of them probably are late.
Yeah, oh yeah, almost certainly, yeah.
Late as in around the Abhidhamma time or even later then?
Even later, yeah.
Even later.
Yeah. But I mean, again, the commentaries, like all this literature, it's passed down, it's not just invented. When you say it's late, right? Late doesn't mean that somebody just sat down and invented it out of the top of their head. You know, the commentary is a record of an oral tradition of discussion and teachings and so on about the suttas, and that tradition has accumulated over hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. So we know for a fact that there are things which are told in the commentaries which were historically true, and they've been confirmed by the archaeology and so on and so forth, right? So they clearly do have genuine memories in there, but then of course there's so many other things that are added on as well. So yeah, that's another whole field of study, and it's one which has not been really pursued in any great detail. Modern scholars, really, we've been struggling to keep up with the suttas and haven't really put much attention on the commentaries.
Because if you compare the stories, the background stories preserved in the Chinese translation,
right,
they are very often different from the Pali one.
Exactly, yeah. So you find, see,
the verses are the same.
The verses are the same. It's a very similar situation to I mentioned with the Padimokkha and the Vinaya rules, right? The rules themselves are the same, but then the background stories and explanations are different, yeah? And it's a similar thing with the Dhammapada and other verses where you preserve the same verse but then give a completely different background story. Which, again, there's nothing wrong with that because, well, the verse might be quite applicable in different contexts, right? So, but the story is used as an illustration and so on and so forth, but the verse contains the main core teaching. I mean, one of the great examples of that is the story of Alavaka, the Yaka, where there's a fantastic background story for him in one of the Chinese Dhammapadas, which goes into all of these details and so on, which you don't find in the Pali tradition at all. So, yeah.
But they, how will you place Patisambhita Magga?
Patisambhita Magga among the late books of the Kudika, generally speaking, that's regarded as being possibly even later than the Abhidhamma books, but I'm not sure about that. I would place it 300 to 400 years after the Buddha.
You will place it later than Abhidhamma?
Well, I'd place it at least in the late portion of the Abhidhamma, yeah, probably, you know, more or less contemporary. Yeah, again, 300 to 400 years after the Buddha, something like that. Yeah. Why, what do you think?
I'm not sure, because...
Not sure, yeah.
Because the whole Visuddhimagga is actually built on this.
Right. Yeah. So that's very very influential in the Theravada tradition. Yeah. Possibly even more influential than the Abhidhamma Pitaka, actually. Yeah.
It is displayed in the Sutta collection rather than the
right.
Abhidhamma.
So it's a bit of an anomaly, right? It's very much an Abhidhamma style text, and somehow it's there in the Kudika. So, yeah. But I know that, I mean, A.K. Warder did the English translation, and that's his conclusions was that it was probably to be dated around, you know, towards the later part of the Abhidhamma canon. Yeah. Do we have time for one more question? One or two more? Two more questions. Go on.
Bhante, there seems to be two competing models now, one advanced by Professor Norman and the other by Venerable Analayo, regarding the relationship between the reciters, the Bhanakas, and the commentators. Professor Norman takes the view that they were two separate groups,
okay,
and that the commentators actually, you know, serve as a sort of check to preserve the purity of the suttas,
okay,
because as time went on, you know, the Pali underwent more and more Sanskritization, and some of the meanings may have been lost when the text was Sanskritized, but the okay. commentators somehow managed to remember the original Prakrit meanings. So Norman proposes that, you know, sometimes the commentaries are more correct than the suttas. Okay. And he suggests that they are actually two separate groups and that the commentators actually kept checks on the reciters, whereas Venerable Analayo actually thinks that they are unified and that there was no distinction between a reciter and a commentator, and they basically worked as one unit. Where do you think the evidence points?
Look, I'm not sure. I haven't looked at that particular debate in detail, so I couldn't really say. It would seem to me perhaps a bit of both. I'm not sure. I mean, the case is that Norman's talking about... I don't know if they prove his point so much. All they prove is that the commentaries maintained an earlier explanation for a word whose form changed somewhat in later times. But it's quite possible to do that, even though, you know, you might be still unified with the Sutta tradition. I'm not sure if that... I honestly don't know. All I could say is that in the contemporary Sangha, it's the same people who memorize them, pretty much. There's certainly no hard and fast distinction along those lines in the contemporary Sangha. You know, like in the Burmese monks, when they memorize the Tripitaka and so on, they also memorize the commentary. Yeah, so, but we know very little about the Bhanaka system, so it's fairly tenuous either way. Yeah. Sorry, yes.
Very simple question. What's proto-Abhidhamma?
Oh, proto-Abhidhamma means elements that we find in the suttas that seem to look like Abhidhamma, and they have characteristics which we associate with the Abhidhamma, but somehow we find them in the suttas. So in that case, it's either the case that there were certain things which the Buddha taught, which the Abhidhamma people then took up and made special, right? Or it's the other way around. Certain things which the Abhidhamma people developed, which later sort of filtered back into the suttas a little bit. There's probably a bit of both of those things happening. But there are some cases, at least two cases, where it seems to me fairly clear that there was an influence from the Abhidhamma into the suttas. Yeah. So we might talk about those a bit later on, yeah.
But I thought the suttas, what's in the suttas is earlier than the Abhidhamma.
Generally speaking, it is, yes.
So how could that be into the Abhidhamma?
Well, these things are a bit leaky, aren't they?
Okay.
Yeah, the boundaries are never 100%.
Okay.
Yeah? I went into my... yesterday I heard this noise in the bathroom, in the room just there. And I was like, what's that? And I opened the door and I'm like, oh my God, there's a squirrel! Right? And there was a squirrel jumping around the bathroom. And I look at the window and there's like a little opening in the window and this squirrel had got in there and I'm like, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? So I get now, whatever, I'm just trying to find this bucket and I'm like, okay, squirrel, just chill, okay? and squirrels leaping, bouncing around. I'm like, okay, I'll see if I can get this thing in this bucket. I'm thinking, I do not have much good chance here. And it was just like bouncing around the bathroom and everything, and then eventually, before I managed to do anything, it snuck out the window, the same little hole that had been before. Yeah, so a bit like the simile of the cat, right? You can't quite keep all the cats out. So even though there are the baskets and the containers that keep these things safe, keep them separate and distinct, but those things are never 100%. Yeah, yeah. So always a few squirrels eating even the corners. Okay. it looks like we have no more questions right now. Let's have a break. We'll come back at, we'll give you till 5 past 4. We'll come back and we'll have the next discussion session. Okay. Calling all sentient beings, the formless and without form, the awake and the sleep. The two-legged and the four-legged, small and large, thin and fat, long and short. May they all come and assemble here together. Okay, very good. So, we're coming to our second discussion session. Oh, I should bring that up. Okay. So these discussions are going to build on what we've learned before. And we're going to split up into groups again. And please go into different groups each time. Don't hang out with the same people that you knew before. You know, that's just attachment, right? So if you hang out with the same people the whole time, that's where you're going to get reborn, right? And you're going to get reborn with them the next time. It's going to get really boring after a while. So you practice detachment to go and hang out with some new and exciting friends. And it was a bit loud, wasn't it? So we're going to try to split it up a little bit more. And I think we can have one group go into the library. Okay? So if you go through the corridor into the library, one group go in there. Two groups upstairs. Okay? What? Okay, good point. Okay, so no, don't say it was too noisy. Maybe somebody can note down, or yes, good point. You can capture it on your phone. Good, Beta's got it on her phone. A couple of people can take photographs of it. Go on, and then you can have those and keep them in mind. So we'll have, I think that'll be five groups here. One group in the library, two groups upstairs. So let's go. And we'll be back here at in 1 hour's time, so 5:10. And we'll have a closing session and discussion here at 5:10. Okay, let's go. Thank you. Okay, so, can everyone settle down? Then we'll just quickly wrap up the session for today. So we've covered quite a lot of ground, so I don't want to introduce anything more in this final session. I think we've covered quite a number of things. So I'll maybe just give a very brief summary of what we've talked about today, and then open up and see if there's any final questions. So we've introduced the concept of early Buddhism. That's the Buddhism taught by the Buddha and practiced for the first generations of his disciples. And we've looked at how this topic on understanding of early Buddhism is something that emerged and grew in the world in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, especially with the work of the Western Indologists, but also with the various reformers in the different Buddhist countries. And we've seen that even though this has taken many different forms in different places, sometimes textual-based, sometimes social-based, sometimes meditation-based, but it always has a number of characteristics that are common, such as it has a reforming spirit, it has a transformative spirit, it has a kind of back-to-the-roots spirit, and it has an evidence on being rational and reasonable and scientific and moving away from practices that are too superstitious and magical based. And this is kind of a strong trend that we've seen through Buddhism through the last 100 years. We've also looked at the social context and political context in the time of the Buddha, and the language, the text, the form of the early Sangha, and all of those things, and how did these suttas get formed? We have this idea that the Buddha taught, that his students memorized it, that they organized in groups, and that they passed this down through the various schools of Buddhism. And we've had a brief survey of the texts which constitute the corpus of teachings of early Buddhism. The Pali texts, which are the best known, the best studied, but also the vast volume of material in Chinese translation, and lesser material in Sanskrit and Tibetan. And so we've got some idea of what we're talking about when we're talking about early Buddhism. We haven't talked much about the content of early Buddhism yet, and so that's something we're going to be moving on to in the next sessions. So far we've been looking mainly at the context and so on. And so one of the things which I've tried to emphasize is that whatever form and whatever shape that Buddhism takes, it takes on a form which reflects the context and reflects the environment and the people around you. Even though it will often seem, like when you encounter Buddhism in its various forms, it often seems like it's something that's kind of always been there, right? Religion has this timeless quality. And in a sense, there's some truth to that. I mean, you know, you look at the fashions, okay? I mean, Buddhist fashions don't really change quickly, you know, like in the actual fashion world, it's like, you know, either this year's colours are out and next year's colours are in and everything's got to be different, right? So, well, you know, our hemlines remain the same length from year to year, and the patterns, see, not many people realize that the Buddha was actually the world's first fashion designer. Yeah? And the best. I mean, you know, how many other people have designed a fashion that's been, you know, worked perfectly well for 2,500 years, right? Still going strong, right? Yeah? So people don't really appreciate the Buddha's role as a also the world's first weight loss diet, right? In the suttas, the Buddha taught the King Pasenadi how to lose weight. Yeah? Yeah? How to lose weight? Don't eat too much. The first and still the best weight loss diet, right? Moderation, yeah? So many things like this, yeah, that we find in the Buddhist text. So all of these things give some flavor to it. They give the context. They're actually real people, you know. And when you meet these characters like King Pasenadi or Ajatasattu and all of these people, they're actually fully fleshed out kind of living people. And you know, we see the records of them struggling and trying to apply the Dhamma in their own time and place. We see that also in some of the verses of the monks. I recently did a translation of the Theragata, one of the great collections of verses in the Buddhist canon, and it has the inspired verses of the monks. And one of them, or a few of them, you know, you see that they talk about the struggles that they had, you know, and you have, for example, Thalaputta, who gives these long verses where he's talking. He addresses these verses to his mind as if his mind's like a third person. And he says, "You mind, you're such a traitor. You know, you told me when I was living in the home, you told me that when I became a monk, I'd be so peaceful living on the mountaintop. And you kept on saying, oh, it'll be so lovely to be meditating in the forest and to be peaceful. But now I'm here in the forest and you can't stop thinking about what it was like beforehand. What are you doing to me, mind?" So you see, these are like real people, and there's struggles that we're seeing. So early Buddhist texts, and one of the things which is so fantastic about them, they're always very vital. They're always challenging. There's always something about them which is a bit difficult to hear, because they may be asking something of us which we're not sure whether we're ready to do. Yeah? And this is one of the marks of a great spiritual literature. It's not there to just make you feel good. Okay? This is not chicken soup for the Buddhist soul. Okay? This is not there just to sort of, you know, this is there to make you feel uncomfortable, right? To make you think, oh, maybe I need to be doing something different with my life. And people have been coming to me with these questions. How do I apply this, right? I can't tell you how to apply it, right? I'm just here to make you feel uncomfortable. Then you go away and deal with that yourself. Yeah? And so, but that's where that really deep questioning comes from. We ask ourselves, what is our life about? What am I doing? What's of the greatest value to me? Can I be living my life in a better way? Yeah? Can I be challenging things? And so when we're teaching early Buddhism, it's not an exercise in nostalgia. And it certainly isn't and shouldn't be a fundamentalism, right? Now, I want to just talk very little briefly about what fundamentalism is, right? Now, we have this idea, people who sell you fundamentalism, whether Buddhist or any other kind, will tell you, will present this idea that it's the kind of original true form of a religion, right? It's complete balderdash, right? Fundamentalism is a sheer invention. It's a modern invention of people's imagination of some past that has never existed. Okay? And fundamentalism is actually a form of Buddhist modernism. Okay? It's dysfunctional Buddhist modernism. Right? So when religions encounter modernity, every religion has encountered modernity, you have two responses, right? You can either move forward into it and with it, right? Or you can try to fight against it and pretend that it isn't going to happen. Right, that's fundamentalism, yeah, and that's where you can see in America the Christians tying themselves in knots over this ridiculous creationism stuff. I mean, it's so ludicrous, you know. They are just digging themselves this grave. It's so silly, you know. And then all around the world, and in Buddhism, we also find this fundamentalist streak within Buddhism. It's not so strong. It's not so destructive, right? But it's still there. And so we need to be conscious of this and say, no, actually a vital religion, a real healthy spiritual religion doesn't fight against the time that it's in, right? But it engages with that time and engages with it in a positive and constructive way. Right? In the group that I was just talking with, people were raising questions, and this is something that I've heard so many times. People say, oh, you know, look at the Christians, look at how successful they are at reaching the youth and all of these things and so on. And people are like, oh, Buddhists need to emulate those things. You do not need to emulate those things, okay? This is just marketing. This is so shallow, and it will burn itself out in a generation, okay? This is the last thing you have to worry about, okay? This is just short-term stuff, okay? There's no spiritual depth to it at all, right? the concern that Buddhists have to have in the Buddhist community is how strong is our Buddhist practice? How strong is the Buddhist institutions and teachings? That's what we need to worry about. That's what we need to improve. Don't worry about what the Christians do, okay? Every Western country in the world, the Christians are importing priests from Asia, okay? Christianity is falling apart in all of those countries, okay? You know, if you'd want us to ask, what is actually the real vital energetic forces in the world today, okay? Yeah? Okay? What is actually the cutting edge? Okay? You look at people like Google, right? Google is basically a Buddhist company, right? They run these whole search inside yourself programs. They have meditation everywhere. The whole of Silicon Valley is basically Buddhist. The whole of San Francisco is Buddhist. Steve Jobs is Buddhist. Apple is basically a Buddhist company, right? Hollywood has been selling Buddhism for decades, right? The Matrix, yeah? But even that was, you know, I mean, what about Yoda, right? I mean, Yoda was explicitly based on the abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, right? I mean, he's not, you know, his whole speech patterns and everything is modeled after the old Chinese Zen monk. He's basically a Buddhist monk with a lightsaber, right? Right? So they've been finding ways to, you know, and it's in Star Wars, it's always kind of, you know, be mindful of your feelings and all of this kind of stuff, right? I mean, they're right there teaching Buddhism, yeah? And they've put it, and we're asking, oh, it's so hard to make Buddhism how do we bring Buddhism to the youth? Really? Well, Star Wars seemed to connect with the youth, I don't know. Seemed to work okay, right? Yeah? So why can't we actually, rather than being worried about, you know, being these things. Why can't we shouldn't be being worried about being evangelized or anything like this. We should be looking to the cutting edge. We should be looking to what's the most advanced and what's the most lively parts of our global culture. Yeah, and those parts are full of Buddhism already, right? Yeah, or they're not. You know, where are the Buddhist video games, right? Where are the Buddhist video games? Who's made a Buddhist video game? Right? Buddhism has a long tradition with gaming, right? Snakes and Ladders, okay? Snakes and Ladders is a Buddhist game, right? It's all about samsara, good karma, bad karma, going out. Seriously. Right? Seriously. Right? So we should... Where's our Buddhist video games? Where are we doing those kinds of things, yeah? In Australia, we have one of the leading members of the Vietnamese Buddhist community is a woman called Tan Le. Actually, she's someone you should invite to come and give talks here. Tan Le runs a company called Emotive. They do brain scanning things, right? You can run your computer by scanning your brain, right? And you go to their website and they have meditation apps, right? So you can actually get the computer to read your brain and tell you how to meditate. Okay, so it's a bit creepy, but... But, you know, you can see this is like a cutting edge, right? These are the kinds of things where you can see Buddhism actually is, it's right there. Buddhism is all the psychology, all the neuroscience, all of these things are being done together with Buddhism. It's right through all of this stuff, yeah? It's not just a little bit here and there. It's absolutely fundamental. So when we have a grounding in what the Buddha was teaching, what the actual fundamental Buddhist teachings are, we have the strength of that. We have the strength in our own practice, yeah. But we also need to have the strength to say how do we apply that in the most vital and creative and real and meaningful ways in our time and in our place. Sorry, Beta. GarageBand, yeah, GarageBand, right? You've used GarageBand on your Mac. Anyone? Young people have? Yes? GarageBand? No? Oh, yeah, a few people have. Yeah.
GarageBand. You must explain that, John. What's GarageBand?
It's the music making app for Mac, right? Yeah, the guy who wrote it spent the Rains Retreat at Bodhinyana. Yeah? So he's and we're working on with him to make a Pali text-to-speech engine. So that's one of his little hobbies that he's doing. But he's still working. He was with a group of developers who wrote GarageBand, and then they got bought by Apple a number of years ago, and he still works for Apple. And so he came to spend the rains retreat with us in Bodhinyana. Yeah. And again, that's entirely normal within those kind of cultures. That's what they do. They were meditators and so on. And so, you know, they've brought these Buddhist ideas to those things. Yeah. This computer, Asus ZenBook. Right? That's what they call it, ZenBook. Right? They don't call it Jesus Book. No. Right? Nobody does that. I haven't seen a computer release they call Jesus Book. Why? Because Zen's cool, right? Yeah, why not? Right? And they've used all of these Buddhist kind of ideas of simplicity and mindfulness and the care and all of these kinds of things, and they've actually applied them. So we've got so many good examples of people who've done these things. So, you know, I think that's something we should all be looking to and, you know, contributing to, being a part of. We should be part of that. Buddhism is actually a part of that leading edge of culture, which is way ahead of the curve. We shouldn't be doing these kind of turf wars with other religions. We should be out there in the front, leading the way and creating new things and new ways of doing things that's going to inspire others to follow us. Yeah. Okay. Inspirational speech over. Any questions? I think we're just about finished. Are there any last questions before we wrap up? Which Q&A? Which? Yeah, what comments? I have no comments. Yep.
We're asking for standard answers to those questions.
What's the right answer? Yeah. Okay, do we have a question?
Rajan, I have a few questions. The first question is there any sutta text that mentioned this regarding the Bardo state, that Mahayana believe that there's such a Bardo state? Is there any sutta Buddha did utter about, comment about this?
Yeah, there's a few. It seems to be taken for granted in the suttas that there's some kind of in-between process between one life and the next. Yeah.
So the second question is regarding dedication about marriage. Is there any effect on the person pass on, and how it would actually affect the person that pass on?
I'm not sure. Maybe if it does have an effect, it's always explained in terms of, it's, you know, you can't transfer merit, right? And in fact, the word that they use in Pali is uddhisa, which doesn't mean to transfer. It means to dedicate or to direct, right? So it's about just dedicating or having a thought of that person. And the explanation that I've heard is that if you make those offerings, if it's the case that the departed relatives can be aware of what's going on, which isn't always the case, but if they can, then it's basically kind of mudita, that they realize that their family still loves them, that they're thinking of them, so they don't feel lost and they don't feel cut off. And so the benefit that you're giving is not because you're actually transferring it, but because there's an appreciation and a gratitude that's generated there. Yeah, I mean, it's like anything, you know, if you walk into the room, if you have a good mood, other people in the room will have a good mood too. You know, it's not, there's nothing magical about it, but you're just creating that positive energy. And even if it doesn't help them, it'll probably help you anyway.
Another question is regarding this Amitabha Sutta that, based on my understanding, that certain teacher mentioned that this sutta had been teached to Bimbisara when he in jail by Buddha at the vulture pit. The first question is like, is that a genuine sutta that we are referring to? And the second question is regarding the practice of this so-called Western paradise that purported by this Amitabha Sutta. Whether is it there's a real such thing called Western paradise from the Buddhism practice?
Yes, there is a Western paradise. It's called Perth. And And yes, it's infinite light. Yeah, if you've been in Perth in the summer and you look up in the sky, you think, wow, that's really something. So, but I mean, the Amitabha Sutta is you know, it's one of the Mahayana Sutras, probably dated about 2nd century AD, something like that. And you know, if you look at what the Amitabha Sutta is, I mean, to me, that's a classic case of where something has a, you can see something actually has a role and a function in its place. Now, what the Buddha did teach, and one of the meditations that he taught very often, was the recollection of the Buddha, Buddhanusati. Yeah. And, you know, you recollect, what's the purpose of that? Well, you recollect the great qualities of the Buddha. It brings joy and it brings, you know, life to your mind, and then you can use that and you enter samadhi. Now, the Sanskrit name of the Amitabha Sutra is the Amitāryu Dhyāna Sutra, right? Which means the jhana of Amitabha, okay? Amitabha, the jhana of infinite light sutra, right? So, actually, that's what jhana is, isn't it? It's an experience of limitless light. You recollect the Buddha, and then doing that, you develop the joy and so on, and you have an experience of infinite light. So my interpretation of that is that, you know, the purpose of that sutra actually was really to teach that kind of practice of jhana based on a recollection of the Buddha. So, you know, I don't think it was meant to be taken literally. I think it was meant to be taken as an inspirational kind of guide for raising people's minds to a conception to a realization of that Amitabha, the infinite light. Yeah.
Next question is regarding the Hatha Sutta. It's usually derived from the Western hips of the Sutta. That, yeah, based on my understanding, they actually have this strong concept of emptiness.
Yeah.
Is that emptiness concept very similar to what is mentioned in the Sutta? And if yes or no, what is the relationship of the emptiness concept related to the non-self?
Okay, well, that's a very complicated question, but very, very briefly, my understanding is that the Prajnaparamita literature was developed as a critique of the Abhidhamma. Okay, now if you look at the timing, the Abhidhamma 200 to say 400 years after the Buddha. The Prajnaparamita Suttas emerged shortly after that. One of the points that I made here early is that we look at the evolution of doctrine. Okay? The evolution of doctrine, very important. Now, in the Heart Sutra, particularly, okay? Now, when you chant that in Chinese, you go that it begins and that Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara was looking down on the world and declared that the five khandhas are empty, right? That's not what the Sanskrit text says, okay? The Sanskrit text says, you look down and you see that the five khandhas are swabhava shunya, okay? Swabhava shunya, and the word swabhava is omitted from the Chinese translation, okay? But swabhava means inherent essence, okay? That they are, things are empty of inherent essence, okay? What does that mean? Well, swabhava is a fundamental concept in the Abhidhamma, right? It's not found in the suttas, right? And what swabhava means is that things exist in and of themselves, right? And the critique of the Prajnaparamita and of Nagarjuna was to say that this contradicts the teaching on dependent origination, because things don't exist in and of themselves, they exist interrelated. They exist in dependence on other things. Yeah, and that the idea of swabhava is an Abhidhamma idea, contradicts the notion of dependent origination and contradicts the notion of not self. Okay, so when you look at the Heart Sutra from that angle, it's a sustained critique of the Abhidhamma, and in many of the Mahayana sutras, that becomes very clear that that's in fact what's happening. For example, there's a Mahayana sutra called the. Yeah, it'll come to my mind in a moment, or not, depending. It says, here a bodhisattva is sitting in the forest and meditating, and they meditate and experience the quiet of emptiness and so on. Then they rise out of that meditation and they come to the city and they see the monastery, and in the monastery they see all of the monks arguing about the five khandhas and their characteristics and their origin and their cessation, and they argue about dependent origination and the factors of dependent origination and the characteristics and so on and so forth, and it lists all of the teachings of the Abhidhamma. Okay? And it says all of these monks are arguing about these things and none of them understand the true flavor of the Dhamma. None of them understand the flavor of release. None of them understand peace of mind. Yeah? And so this is what those suttas was. It was a critique of this Abhidhamma speciality, arguing about all the definitions of Dhamma and so on, and not actually experiencing it for yourself. Yeah? So this is my understanding, is that this is where the Prajnaparamita literature came from. And so it was reasserting those teachings of dependent origination and so on. This is what Nagarjuna says, you know, emptiness is just dependent origination. Yeah.
So
we're probably going to have to cut you off there. I'm sorry, we're already over time. So right?
We'll keep the questions for tomorrow.
Yep. More questions tomorrow. Don't worry. Yeah.